From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on December 27th on openmicrock.com. Open Mic is a locally based online black publication with news, interviews, opinion pieces, and a platform for discussion. And the week before Christmas, Open Mic told the story of the so-called Soul Santa, in which Grease Ridge Mall had a black Santa. The story focused not only on the people who brought an African-American Santa to a local mall, but on the reactions of the shoppers from all backgrounds. And you really should check it out. It's still up on the site now. Recently, Open Mic has covered the debate over La Marqueta and the city of Rochester. Yesterday, the staff sat down for an interview with Mayor Lovely Warren, a sign of growing respect for what Open Mic is doing. Now, the piece I referred to from December 27th came with a graphic with the words, quote, "You're pretty for a black girl," end quote. The story was about microaggressions, what they are, how they impact people, how to recognize them. And yes, we've heard from some listeners in the past when we've talked about these issues who don't even think microaggressions are real or worth discussing. Open Mic says otherwise. And this hour, it's our chance to explore in more detail the work that Open Mic is doing in our community, from the microaggressions piece to a lot of other stories, their sit down with the mayor and more. So let me go ahead and welcome my guests for the hour. And they include the editor-in-chief of Open Mic, Tiana Magnon. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Also here is Nylan Lovelace. He's a staff reporter. Nylan, welcome.
Thank you.
Vanessa Cheeks is a staff reporter as well. Vanessa, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Michelle Ashley is a staff photographer. I think the last time we were talking was a couple of years ago.
Yes.
On some of the work you've done in town. So staff photographer for Open Mic. You've been working with them for how long?
2 months.
2 months now.
Two months.
How's it going?
It's incredible.
Very good.
Great.
Well, Tiana, we were just kind of talking about Open Mic's history. Mm-hmm. It's been around for a number of years, but really got the relaunch into what it is now last summer. Is that right?
Yeah. Chappelle Thompson is our publisher. Mm-hmm. I had just moved back from D.C., and he reached out to me, and I thought it was a great idea. There's not too many black publications that's really doing this kind of thing. So, and we decided we wanted to sit down, and we worked out that we wanted to be a serious news publication. We wanted to take the very traditional approaches to journalism, always make sure that we're fact-checking, but to also make sure that we're focusing on stories that often go unheard in our community, mm-hmm. and given that perspective.
Do you come with any sort of advocacy bent, a political point of view?
No, I try not to. I actually went to school for journalism and political science, so I see myself as a very hard news reporter. I went to D.C. to cover politics, actually. So when I went into this, I made it clear, and we worked that out, we don't want to have any advocacy just because you're black. We're not going to support you. If you're a Democrat, we're not going to support you. We actually did a piece on black people who supported Trump and did it seriously. So.
Okay. Well, mm-hmm. I want to talk about, first of all, the piece on microaggressions, because I thought, especially for someone like me, a white guy, this is good. Very good for me to kind of get a chance to read and learn and kind of try to internalize here and understand what it is. And as I've said, Tiana, we've had programs about, university safe spaces, microaggressions, mm-hmm. Debates about free speech on campus. And there's always some pushback from people, some listeners who think, what is a microaggression? Is it a real thing? The terminology, I think the piece was sharing, goes all the way back to early 1970s, right?
Yeah, and I think Nylan is probably, he just knocked the ball out of the park with that piece. I assigned it to him, and that was amazing. So,
Nylan, so give us a sense for how you approached writing that piece, not only from the history, sort of explaining the terms and the impacts there.
So one of the biggest issues is that when it comes to microaggressions, it's typically hard to define because you have to decide, what is a microaggression? Is it physical? Is it just verbal? And why do people do it? So the first thing was analyzing the different types of microaggressions. So for the most part, people know verbal microaggressions, like saying, oh, you're pretty for a black girl. So it's meant to be a compliment, but in reality, it's backhanded. It has a lot of history that's, dissolved about racism and misogynoir. But at the same time, you have physical ones that are environmental. So a lot of black people know when you approach, other non-black people, they have a sense where they kind of pull in a little tighter, clutch their purse. And people don't see that as a microaggression because, one, they're not really aware they're doing it. The same through the verbal. They don't know that they're saying, they're stereotyping you like, oh, well, you're pretty for a black girl. So that means black innately is less beautiful. So the first thing was trying to identify and define something that people really don't know they're doing in the first place.
All right. So there are categorically intentional and unintentional microaggressions.
Correct.
Are most microaggressions, from what you sort of have kind of composed with this, do you think most are unintentional?
Most microaggressions are unintentional. It's really what you're taught to be a norm. So when you said you don't think there's anything wrong with it whatsoever, you may say something like, you're pretty for a what, black girl, just thinking that you have a preference for non-black people. Like, oh, well, you know, generally I just don't date or find black people attractive. So it seems so normal to you because you're told that you're allowed to have that preference, you're allowed to have that opinion. So you're not intentionally saying, oh, I'm engaging in racism or I'm engaging in aggression towards you, because you have no idea that it's aggression in the first place.
Okay. And you know, my mind immediately goes back to the 2008 presidential campaign when Joe Biden, who was at the time in the primary running against Barack Obama, called him articulate. And a lot of people said, you know, almost like, almost as if to say, wow, you're articulate. Or, you know, I might not have expected a person of color to be articulate. And so that was one that I think Biden had to wear. And that the obviously the president put that behind him, and they've had a great relationship. But is that also the kind of microaggression that people of color will hear?
It really is, because you have to think about when you hear that, you rarely hear that for people who aren't people of color, unless it's specifically something where you have to be articulate. So, you know, you're trying to articulate a certain point in like a debate or something. They may say, oh, you know, you articulate that very well. But in general life, you know, we hear that just because we're talking to someone on the street and it's like, oh, you're very well spoken. And it's like, why wouldn't I be? It's like you're assuming that we have the same education from the same place, and you're really presenting to me an expectation that I'm not well-spoken for some reason, though you have no basis besides my ethnicity to assume that I won't be well-spoken, because people don't identify like Ebonics or African-American vernacular English as legitimate language, though we have linguistic rules, semantics. You know, there are rules that we follow in Ebonics that are followed in Spanish, Latin languages, Asian languages that we don't follow in English, so they discredit it.
Okay. And for those who think, well, this is sort of a modern invention, the idea of microaggressions to suit what they view as a further left-moving kind of campus movement, you know, the piece helped flesh out some of the history that goes back a number of decades with this, right?
Yeah. To be honest, the piece itself just goes back to when they first started to define microaggressions. I can literally show you for hundreds and hundreds of years that microaggressions have been in place. If you look at, there was a recent video about the Czech Christmas devil that people know as Krampus, and I pointed out, oh, well, this is obvious blackface, and they say, oh, no, it's just a holiday, it's this, it's that, and I'm like, no, it's very specifically targeted at Moors who invaded Europe, who helped Europe prosper, but they wanted to excommunicate them, so they made darker-skinned people the villain in all these cases. It got to the point where you look at all the villains and the heroes, all of those are always dark-skinned. It's a microaggression that people tend to just ignore because they think, oh, it's tradition, there's nothing wrong with it. And it's like, no, they're actually specifically targeting dark-skinned people, which is exactly why a lot of dark-skinned people don't participate in the first place, because they understand the history, they understand the concepts. So microaggressions have been going on for a long time, just that they haven't been addressed as directly as they have been until about the 1970s.
Yeah, I recall, and I think we brought this up in the program before, but I recall an interview last year with Mark Cuban in which he very openly talked about the fact that, you know, for example, if he's walking down the street and he sees a black man wearing a hoodie, he may feel, well, I'll walk to the other side of the street. And he's less likely to do it if it's a white man with a hoodie. And Mark Cuban was at least admitting, saying, I got to ask myself, why am I doing this? And you know, some people would say, well, but okay, but that didn't change that person's life. The black man in the hoodie walking down the street, it didn't change his life. But what you're pointing out is
it does.
You notice that.
We
you
do
feel
notice.
That.
We notice literally all the time, and we take a mental note. So at some point in time, there are a lot of times people argue about how should you respond to microaggressions. So there are some people who would ignore. A lot of people in that situation would possibly ignore, go on about their day. But, you know, kind of have a little thing in their mind, like, okay, seriously, why is this happening still? There are a lot of people who would address it up front. Like, more likely, I would address it up front, like, hello, is there a problem? You know, because some people will go across the street and then come back. Or they'll stare at you, or they, like, move out your way or wait for you to move or something.
So you address it pretty directly?
For the most part. It's the kind of person I am. Like, my filter's kind of low for the most part. So I do address a lot of things directly. There's also one that, you know, when you're, there's a test, you know, when you walk in a hallway and someone's in your way, black people of color are expected to move out of the way. So there's actually a test that's actual, that's an environmental microaggression that you have such a presence that someone needs to get out of your way. So they did a test to see if it's a white person, do other people out of the way. If it's a person of color, do people out of the way. Literally every time person of color got bumped into continuously down the hall, that's one of those things that we noticed. And that's one of the things I was addressed to, like, excuse you. You know, like, stop. I want you to recognize that you did this. Because a lot of times people take it as a slight that you should have gone out of the way. And it was like, I was standing here perfectly fine. You were walking towards me. Maybe you should have taken some notice. And it's one of those things people don't think about because we've always been taught, oh, you see someone coming, move out the way. You know, it's only polite. But some people just expect it to happen for them. That's another microaggression that people just... It's environmental. People don't think about it until someone addresses it. So that's why I like to bring it up. Because if I don't bring it up, you're going to continue to do that behavior. And I want you to think about it next time that maybe you should adjust to your environment.
Talking to Nylan Lovelace, the staff reporter for Open Mic Rochester, who wrote the story on microaggressions. And if you want to check it out, it's easy to find on their website. But I also want to let you know, if you want to call the program, maybe share your stories. If you have questions about microaggressions. And we're going to move on and talk about some of the other work they're doing as well. But throughout the hour, if you've got questions about that, if you want to share your own stories of, let me just say, Tiana, I saw you post on social media kind of asking for people to share their microaggression stories, and you got a lot of feedback from people who are kind of sharing their own instances. Mm-hmm. And I'll say the same thing. I felt just reading those the same way I felt about reading Nylan's piece. It's good for me to read that and just think about that. But you can call the program and share those stories if you want. It's 844-295-TALK. Toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. What are some that come up immediately to mind for you, Tiana?
Some of the main ones, you definitely brought up the articulate one. That is the most common one because a lot of people of color are going to college now. So it's a growing thing. More of us are in the professional workplace. More of us are forced to kind of come up against this very hegemonic issue that we are up against. So that's one of them. But I also want to point out just for this conversation that it's not just race-based. And Nylan got into that.
Yeah.
Another great one that I mentioned to you is that I went to RIT. If you see someone who is deaf, you automatically speak slower instead of louder. Mm-hmm. They're not dumb. I mean, they just can't hear. There's just one thing different about them. That's one. And also just assuming... I guess just that maybe that women, for some reason, may be more emotional. Just whatever stereotype that you kind of act upon, even if it's a small slight, that's a microaggression against somebody.
And it wasn't hard for you to find out that your friends, your readers, they feel, you know.
And it's across the board. I mean, for the most part, you have Black people speak up the most, but you also have a lot of Latinx people who say, you know, I'm lumped right into this. And then you also have a lot of women who say, I see this every single day in my workplace.
Yeah, it's a great point. We had a 24-year-old man on the program recently, Latino, who mentioned that when he moved to Rochester from Puerto Rico around age 8, he immediately felt pressure. Obviously, as an 8-year-old, it's a lot to sort of internalize about the world. But looking back, he can now see the pressure on especially kids who are raised with English is not as a first language, the way that society will judge you if you have an accent, if you need to stop or if you misuse a word. And he said, especially for Latino kids in this community, if you're not really up to speed speaking English by middle school, you often get left behind and then you get treated as very, very differently from the really big stuff, hiring, school, class, to the day-to-day, the way people won't even talk to you in a group. They'll assume that you don't have something to add. And that just really sort of stuck with me. So you've lit up the phones, Nylan, with the piece. So Megan Mack and I will make sure we post on Twitter the link to the specific piece on microaggression. You should just go to Open Mic's website in general to check it out. Michelle, before we jump to the phones, do you want to jump in there? Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I really didn't know what microaggression was until now. And when I first took this job, it actually happened to me, which is really unusual being white. Before I went on my interview with Tiana, one of my friends who happens to be Black called me, kind of gave me a little pep talk before I went in to talk to them. And he said to me, do they know you're white? And I was like, whoa, Like, what difference does it make? He said, you realize this is a black magazine, and you now, my friend, are a minority. And I was like, holy cow. Like, I sat there for a minute and really, like, absorbed it and thought about it and thought, I was meant to hear that. I needed to hear that because I'm so diverse and I'm so, I tend to blend really easy. And I'm not threatening to anybody and I've never been threatened by anybody. I wasn't raised to even acknowledge racism, but right then I felt it. And a few times since, being in situations working with the minority community now, I felt it a couple of times. Very, very, very little. I have to say 99% of the time, it's been very welcoming and very loving, and I've walked away feeling nothing but, you know, love. But it is different being white. I am generally one of the only white people sometimes at these situations, and I'm feeling what my friends here have felt before, and I've never been able to say that before.
Yeah, their whole lives, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Just
for us to take
yeah,
for granted.
Sure.
Let me start with Pete in Canandaigua. Go ahead, Pete.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Great conversation. And, you know, I was listening in, and it made me think of something that I felt the other day, looking at a picture in the New York Times about the senior Democratic leadership that had just had their meeting with President Obama, and a picture of them all coming out together. And I caught myself focusing on two things, and it happened to be what Nancy Pelosi was wearing and what another female member of Congress was wearing, which was like a red pantsuit, and the face was kind of obscured. It was an African-American woman. And I thought to myself immediately afterwards, these are some of the most intelligent, accomplished, dedicated, patriotic women in our country, and I'm looking at what they're wearing. And your comments about Mark Cuban asking himself, like, why do I do these things? You know, it made me think to myself, why do I do these things? I'm a white male, middle class white male, and you know, and I don't have an answer as to why I do these things. But I think it's important for everybody to realize and to learn. And your conversation today is really hitting home at this. Is let's just have the conversation. Nobody needs to have the answers right now. How we're going to fix all this. But we will never get to these answers on microaggressions or macroaggressions if we're not willing to have the conversation and say, yes, there is a problem, and it resides in many communities across the country. So I just want to applaud all of you on this conversation, and it's really, really got me thinking about a lot of stuff, and I wanted to say thank you.
Well, Pete, thank you for the phone call. I know they appreciate that, and that's Nylon, what a validation of your work, right?
Right. Like, seriously, that's one of the biggest things. It's not only felt by men, it's felt by women, too, who literally will judge a woman's worth and their ability to do something based on what they're wearing versus their intelligence or what they've done in their profession. There's a thing in Australia where a male newscaster wore the exact same suit for a year.
Yep.
No one said a thing. The female newscaster, I think she wore like a different shade of lipstick than normal, and they literally got like 25 emails like, what are you doing? Like, do you not care about your life? And you look horrible. And it's just like, okay, well, he's literally been wearing the exact same suit for a year, and you haven't, does he wash it? Like, that's a good question to ask. Do you care about her changing her lipstick? So...
Yeah, Pete, thank you for that. I appreciate also just the notion of kind of looking inward. I try to do it myself. Whether it's Nylon's piece or conversations, you heard Rena Golden Collier on the program earlier this week. We had a conversation about employers and what they can fire you for and what they cannot fire you for. You know, just the reminder that implicit bias does live in just about all of us, and it's good to sort of try to get in touch with that as best we can. So Nylon's work, I think, is making us do that. But I know Gary has got a different viewpoint. Let's grab Gary. Go ahead, Gary.
Actually, it's not really a different viewpoint.
Okay.
I think we do have to be aware of how other people perceive what we say and do. I think we can also be oversensitive in defining the motivation of somebody. The example that you had given about what you call micro aggression of walking down a hallway, bumping into somebody and expecting the other person because they're black, to move out of your way. I have my own principle on that. We drive on the right-hand side of the road, so I always walk down the right-hand side of the hallway. If everybody did this, we wouldn't have this dance hallway. It has, and I have to bring this up to people dozens of times, and they usually thank me for it.
Yeah,
but I'm not accusing it because of their female or their, you know, a different gender, I mean, nationality or anything. It's just, hey, do you realize this? It would help a lot if we just did it on the right-hand side?
Gary, I think I understand exactly what you're saying, but I think what Nylon was saying and writing about and trying to express, and Nylon, help me out here, did I take it correctly when I took that to mean when they actually test for these things, black people are treated differently than white people when it comes to, you know, who's expected to move, who gets out of the way, you know, who has the right of way. Even in just walking down a hallway, what Nylon seemed to be saying is black people are treated differently.
Exactly. Okay. A situation when
I agree. I'm just saying that this would be a better way of looking at things is simply trying to look at a more neutral rule that would help everybody.
Yeah, they did definitely take that into account when they did the study. And even the situation when they were on the same side and they observed that rule, white people, if it happened to another white person, there's an apologize. Oh, sorry, my bad. Whereas if it was a black person, if it was a woman, a person of color, it was just like, why are you in the way?
Okay, so just Gary's point's well taken. If everybody walks on the right side of the hallway, it's all good.
We're tweeting that. He just solved one of our microaggressions. Right. We can, like, move on now, guys.
And Gary, I appreciate that, but I think it's also the larger point of just the societal expectation.
Yeah.
You know, who defers, who doesn't, who's got it right away.
It doesn't mean that you simply do it. It's just an expectation that society says it should happen this way.
Andrew in Irondequoit next up. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hey, great show. I worry a little bit about when you point out microaggressions to everybody and they don't even know that they're doing them, that you kind of put people are going to be afraid to talk about it. I think it's great to look inward and ask, you know, why am I doing that or why do I think that way? But if you are so, you know, super sensitive about things, then I worry that the conversation that you want to have, people are going to not join in because they're not going to want to be called, you know, racist or microaggressors or whatever. You know, remember a couple weeks ago, Evan had on David K. Johnston, and he's a wise man, and he was telling Evan to, you know, be careful about calling people, you know, everybody racist. And also another lady from that Center for Peace. What's the guy's name over in India there?
From the Gandhi Institute.
She was saying, why aren't people joining in on our conversation? And I'm saying, you got to be careful about calling everybody racist too quickly because they don't want to, because they're not racist and they do have implicit biases and they don't want to be labeled wrongly, and they're, you know, it's such a super hyped up thing, especially lately, it seems like, that, you know.
But Andrew, I would say I've pointed people to this piece on this program before, and I'll say it again. Vox.com had a piece, I think the title was something along the lines of "Want to Root Out Racism? Stop Calling People Racist."
Yeah.
The idea is not, though, that you can't talk about it. It's that when you kind of go in a very aggressive manner with a finger in someone's chest saying, you're a racist, own it, you know, makes people shut down. There's a difference, I think, than what Nylon's piece did was, first of all, it gave us historical context. It gave us really interesting information, another perspective. And he wasn't asking, especially white readers, to say, oh, I'm a racist. I think what he's asking people is to say, well, how are my actions impacting people of color? What's the impact there? And maybe try to understand that better. Because, Andrew, I do it. Nylon's piece flat out has made me think about certain things and certain daily behaviors. But I also understand what you don't want to feel like people are shutting you down. You know, so Nylon, why don't you respond, you know, about how you feel about his interpretation of the piece in the conversation?
One of the main things to keep in mind is that there's not a single microaggression today that has not historically been addressed over and over again. A lot of these microaggressions, whether it's racial, whether it's based on sex, sexuality, religion, have continuously been addressed. There have been dialogue about it, that no matter how we approach it, it has continuously been ignored, which is why it has turned to a microaggression in the first place. So this is kind of policing the conversation, saying that, well, you need to address it a certain way. My question is, which way would you actually listen? Because I can, for a fact, give you centuries of different ways we present the dialogue, and has continuously been ignored, or it's been addressed, and then it says, oh, we're being oversensitive. I'm not saying anything today that wasn't being said in the 60s, the 50s, the 40s, that wasn't being said in the 1800s. It's just now that we have more access so that we hear more people continuously say it. So it's not sensitivity matter. It's just that now you have more people hearing it. And also, just because you engage in racism does not mean that you're racist. You can engage in active racism, not knowing it or just not being aware that it's racism. Doesn't mean that I'm saying that you are a racist. And the last thing is, if you're more concerned about being called a racist than what you're doing, that someone calls you racist in the first place, then you may want to reflect, because one, you may actually be establishing yourself as a racist in the first place, because you care so much more about your opinion than the fact that you are potentially now intentionally oppressing someone because the way you felt like it's being addressed to you.
Wow, I don't know what he just said, but the way I overcome it is I go to 1 Corinthians 13, where it says the love of God thinks no evil.
I do want to say, under the Bible, they also started slavery and racism, so.
I'm just saying.
I can put it a different way, maybe. I think when you focus on you, you forget about the fact that the other people have been experiencing this their entire lives.
Right.
I actually gave the speech at my college the night we graduated, and I heard a ton of people allege that I only got that because I was a minority, or they were surprised that I went up there and knocked it out the park. I've given a number of speeches, actually, and every single time people are surprised for some reason that I'm articulate, that I can actually word what I want to say and make it powerful enough to impact the audience. So I understand for the people who say it's, you know, they're surprised that I'm articulate, they don't mean to be racist. They actually mean to pay me a compliment. However, for me, the fact that no matter how many times I have given a speech, no matter how many times I present myself well, there's still going to be someone who is just surprised just because they look at me and didn't expect that. So I understand for you it may be frustrating to be called a racist.
Nobody calls me a racist.
But you brought up that point. We've never called anyone a racist for, like, doing these microaggressions. You were the one who said, you know, when you keep calling someone a racist, then you ruin the conversation. What I'm saying is that when you focus on you, you forget about that the other person has been experiencing what you've done from countless other people their entire lives.
I'm not focusing on me. I'm saying people are afraid to talk about this because they're afraid of being called a racist.
Okay, but Andrew, what
I'm talking. I'm not afraid to talk about it. I'm not a racist.
But Andrew, I know everybody sort of wants what's best for everybody here. What Nyland was asking was, if this conversation is not, you know, sort of comfortable enough, what is the conversation in which engaging would be possible, if not this?
The way I address it is I try to discipline my mind to not think evil of people.
Us, the people who are the victims of the microaggression? Are we just supposed to hope that everyone is like you and they go read Corinthians?
Well, you know, there's no easy answer here for this. And it's never going to go away, I'm afraid, because people are not going to. There is no fear in love. So you try to strive to be a loving person, and that's how you overcome these things. That's all I can tell you.
Andrew, I appreciate the phone call, and I'm glad you called. I think what I'm hearing from the staff here is you're focused on you. You're focused on the fact that you don't see evil in other people, but what you're not recognizing is some of the behavior of your fellow men and women are landing in very painful ways to others. And we've got to be able to talk about that if that's going to change.
That's the answer.
I think Nyland, your work is certainly advancing the conversation. I've got I could probably take calls for the next 5 hours. I'm late for a break. I wanted to talk about their sit down with the mayor and the other work that Open Mic is doing. But we'll take more phone calls too. Tiana Mignon is the editor-in-chief of Open Mic, and Vanessa Cheeks and Nylan Lovelace are staff reporters. Michelle Ashley is a staff photographer. And we're talking about the work they're doing. And you see the conversation you're sparking in the community. So we'll get more of your phone calls and talk more about their work after our only break of the hour. Coming up in our second hour, at some point along the line, the terms nerd and geek were taken back and given a different connotation. If you're over the age of 40, you think those terms are still pejoratives. If you're under the age of 40, a lot of new surveys show that you consider them positives and that those are labels you'd like to have for yourself. How did that change? We'll talk about it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. Jess emails the program to say, your guests are phenomenal for being patient. The last two callers come to this issue guarded, and I'm assuming are white men who may be scared of how people perceive them and are doubling down on their points of view. Microaggressions are real, and discomfort is the first step on the road to recovery. That comes from Jess, and Andrew and Gary, I certainly don't want to pick on you, and I want to say again, I'm glad you called. We have to have these conversations. Mm-hmm. Andrew, I'm just worried that, you know, your perception that this is not a constructive way to have the conversation. I think Nylon's point's a good one. Then how are you going to have it? What is the forum? What is the way to have that kind of a conversation? Before we move on to some of their other work, I know a few of you other phone calls wanted to weigh in. Rick in Brockport. Go ahead, Rick.
Yes, hi. You have a great show going.
Thanks.
Let me tell you about my friend Reggie. He lives in Crooked Island in the Bahamas, way down southeast. And I go to visit him, and we just take on a whole new experience. I walk around the island holding hands with him. There's no problems. We are both married guys. I've got a wife. He's got two kids. We just feel very proud of our friendship, and we just walk around and have fun.
That's great, Rick. I mean, that's glad. I'm certainly happy to hear that you can feel comfortable in that setting.
Definitely.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Let me grab Mark in the city of Rochester next up. Go ahead, Mark.
Oh, hello, Evan. Hello, panel. I just wanted to throw my two cents in. First of all, real quick, I think your screener should switch to decaf.
I'll pass that along.
I just started to talk about the fact that, well, an idea for another show, perhaps. I think you could get a panel of people over 60, and we could talk about microaggression as it pertains to senior citizens. Also, people with long hair and beards, I happen to be both. I can't tell you the number of times women have clutched their purses as I've walked by. Walking by a restaurant on Park Avenue, through the glass, they've clutched their purse. And I also want to give a vote to Gary. I think he had a fine idea. I have been nearly bumped off the sidewalk many times because I'm obviously over 60. And it's true philosophically, the old must make way for the new. We must step aside, but not literally.
Well, and Mark, let me jump in to say, first of all, I really appreciate you pointing out the fact that older people can certainly feel left out of conversations. There was an amazing piece in The New Yorker by Roger Angel, and it's probably a couple of years old now because I think he's 95. He's the greatest baseball writer this country's ever had, and by the way, still writing about baseball better than anybody. He was 93 years old, and he wrote a piece on aging. And he wrote about how at that stage in his life, he's 93, he's essentially left out of conversations. He could be in a group of people, and nobody even asks him what he thinks. Because they assume, well, I mean, whatever they assume, that you know, you reach a certain age, and then all of a sudden, people don't want to listen anymore. Mm-hmm. And he wrote about the way that impacted him, and his thoughts on aging. And your comment there, Mark, made me think of Roger Angel's piece, which is just fantastic. I think it's really worth reading. And maybe Megan and I can find it and post it. But I think that's, Nylon, you think that is the same kind of thing that has a psychological impact on someone, the human, a group of people, and you are ignored for whatever the reason is, or you're treated differently.
Right.
Is that the same kind of thing?
For the most part, we've talked about racial microaggressions, but it can definitely be because of class, age, sexuality.
Tattoos
that you're physically able to do stuff. So it's definitely one of those things that, you know, they definitely experience it, especially as you get older, and they just start to mistreat you sometimes, or just there's privilege in youth. So a lot of people take that for granted.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Mark. So let me do this here. Just remind you, we're talking to the staff from Open Mic Online. Where, Tiana?
OpenMicRock.com.
OpenMicROC.com. And it's a black online publication. They're doing a lot of really interesting work. You're hearing about Nylon's work on microaggression, but they've written about La Marqueta, for example, which we've discussed on this program. Had a sit-down yesterday with Mayor Lovely Warren. And Vanessa, you were the one who had to essentially do the interview, as I understand it, right?
Yes.
Okay, so was this your first interview with the mayor?
No, actually, I interviewed her once before for a school project, and I've interviewed her over the phone before as well.
Okay, and this interview, you chose to, you know, you can choose to focus on one issue, you can talk sort of broadly about agenda, you can do kind of a year in review. How do you approach this interview?
So I think our goal was to do a little bit of everything. We definitely wanted to touch on her legacy. She is the first woman black mayor of Rochester, so we definitely wanted to make sure as a black publication that we highlighted that. But we also wanted to challenge her a little bit based on some things in her track record. But we definitely wanted to get an encompassing image of what she stands for and what she's done for the city.
What's an example of something you felt that it was necessary for you to challenge her a little bit on?
We asked her a little bit on her, basically, her stance with organizations like Black Lives Matter and other social justice organizations. Rochester has a steep history in social justice, and she's been criticized for how she, as well as the police department, has dealt with those things. And so when we asked her about it, she definitely had what I would classify maybe as a politician's answer, where, you know, we have to work on both sides of the aisle. I guess in society today, with things that are going on, we definitely want to hear more stances. Like we want to hear something more definite, but at the same time, it's understandable, you know, where she came from on those.
Yeah, I recall this past summer, I think it was in July, where we had there were a number of demonstrations around the country. There was one in Rochester. Mm-hmm. One of the highest arrest totals was in Rochester.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there was, at the time, some questions about whether the mayor herself should have been down there at these various interactions, at the scenes, working with all members of the community, whether it was the police or people who were demonstrating, kind of discussing. And she wasn't there. And the police chief came on this show and said, you know, I asked her not to be. I wanted to make sure she was safe. I didn't want to put her in a difficult position. I'm sort of curious to know, looking back, what she would say about that. So, but you got the sense that she, well, what kind of answer was she giving you regarding, for example, Black Lives Matter, those kind of movements?
I think it's safe to say she wants to work with these organizations. So, you know, that was the vibe that I got. And so her answer to me, I think, left the door open, which I think is important. She emphasized it's important for us to work together. And at the end of the day, you know, it is still, regardless of what we stand for, regardless if, you know, we're pro-police or pro-Black Lives Matter, or we can see both sides of the story, it's important that we still work together. She said something that kind of resonated with me, that the police department is not going away, but these issues aren't going away either. So it's definitely important for us to be able to have these conversations like we are now.
And Vanessa, when are we going to start seeing the work on openmicrock.com? Is it up yet?
No,
oh, she's pointing right
so
at Tiana. Right?
Yeah, so we're actually interviewing a ton of people. I have Bill Johnson next up, trying to get in with the chief. We, like, almost all of Rochester leadership, advocacy groups, even teen empowerment, just to get,
City Council, stuff like that.
City Council. The holidays shook us up. A lot of people were out, but we're thinking early next week, late next week.
Okay, so you want to start reading what Vanessa and Open Mic did in terms of their interview with Mayor Warren, openmicrock.com, and start looking for that sometime next week. And mm-hmm. Vanessa, when it comes to other sort of politics and matters in Rochester, what are your hopes for kind of storytelling, interviews, issues to cover in 2017?
There's so much. But what I've noticed in Rochester is that there is so much emphasis on the good that we're doing, even small businesses, new restaurants, new things going on, events, and oftentimes those conversations are white people doing stories on white businesses and white events. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but since I've started working for Open Mic, I've noticed that a lot of our stories are left out of the conversation. A lot of our new restaurants aren't covered by, you know, even mm-hmm. just the regular reporters who cover new restaurants. And something so small that seems so insignificant means the world to these black businesses that have statistically a harder time getting loans, statistically a harder time bringing in business. So I think that for me, I would like to see Rochester's prosperity include the entirety of our community and not just certain sections of it.
Okay. And Tiana, have you found from City Hall sort of down the line, City Council, other government positions, are you getting more access? Is Open Mic being, you know, sort of treated fairly and with the respect that journalism probably should entail?
I would definitely say very rarely is it an issue to get in with our local official,
okay.
especially, I mean, a lot of them are black themselves.
Yeah.
So once we say we're a black magazine, this is what we're focusing on, they're down to support.
Okay. And mm-hmm. how about leaders who are not black?
Oh, they're even more down. They're like, I don't know if it's just that they're trying to show, like, you know, hey guys,
hey,
I'm down too.
Cool.
You know? Especially when it comes to our political stories, I've never really had an issue getting in with local officials, which is nice.
Okay. Because I saw, you know, I've been not only following your work, but following you on social media and a lot of excitement over sitting down with the mayor. And
mm-hmm.
I think we all have a role. I mean, you talk about white journalists covering, you know, white businesses.
Not intentionally, but it's not even white journalists. I would emphasize too that what I've noticed is it's bloggers, it's, you know, people with social media
yep.
accounts, influencers in the city that are like hitting it big, but they're kind of hitting it big in only one part of the city.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like, okay, but what
to Rochester's.
About everybody
yeah.
else?
Sure. And I guess I want to put my hand up and say, too, because
yeah.
we cover a lot of food. We cover
mm-hmm.
a lot of, you know, aspects of culture. And
you have to go to Arnett Cafe, then.
Ooh, yeah,
if you haven't
waffles.
Been, you are not a serious food blogger unless you've been to Arnett
You're
Cafe.
Slacking.
I really believe that.
Where is that, Tiana?
On Arnett. You just, it's, they have the best chicken and waffles. I mean, really, I kind of throw a little shade at some of the food bloggers who are sharing all of these great places in Fairport, you know, the deep fried garbage plate. That's cool and all, but
mm-hmm.
there's some amazing
mm-hmm.
food in
yeah.
the city.
It doesn't intersect well when it comes to the cultures. And when it does, it's normally a lot of those white businesses who then like adapt and like take food from the people who aren't really,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
focused on, like the famous
mm-hmm.
pho chef. Whereas all the people who actually make pho from their homeland and do it in their homes for $3, you know, it's like, oh, no, here's one for $500. And it's just like, oh, well, we're talking about pho now. That's great. But we're not talking about pho for the people who make pho.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and I think the same thing has to happen just with media conversation. So when we put media roundtables together,
mm-hmm.
get ready for Open Mic to get called more often sometimes because, no, there's a lot of different perspectives and ideas that need to come to the table. And my hand is in the air, too, saying, you know, me too. I mean, this is not me, again, talking from on high. I'm part of that issue. So before I get a few more of your phone calls in, the phone's been ringing all hour, which means more people should be checking out openmicrock.com.
Seriously.
Tiana, I really appreciated the story that you wrote on the Soul Santa.
That was great.
Before Christmas, tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, I drag Michelle to everything. She is the, if you haven't heard of her photography, she's probably one of the best photographers in the city. So it was amazing to bring her on. And I have a couple friends, Good News Photography. He's this amazing photographer in the city. And every single year, he brings Soul Santa. And this was the first year that he brought it to Villa in Grease Ridge. If you're familiar with Villa, then you know they also have a big history in social justice. Even though they're a retail store, they really do focus on the community. So they were there for about a couple days, and I remember being there, and Hank Phelps was the guy behind the beard, and he was just so warm. And what really stood out to me was how many people passed by that window, and you could see a difference in them. You can see a different light come from them. They were smiling. They were happy. Not everyone came in to take a picture, but just seeing him in the window was really something. Mm-hmm. It was really empowering.
It was really cool. It was kind of a, I don't know if I want to use the term novelty, but people, like everybody, they were smiling because it's a little surprising, and little kids were really reacting really well to him.
Mm-hmm. And this was the first time he was in the mall, so you could see him in the storefront. Normally, you know, they were at a,
like the Boys and Girls Club, right? I think he's done it 17 years, 16 years at the Boys and Girls Club.
You know, there have been, it's not hard to find stories in other cities of, you know, white people complaining that Santa was black.
Yeah. Megyn Kelly.
You know, and instances in which people actually argued that, well, Santa can't be black because Santa was white and it's a fictional character.
Right. Yeah. It's really weird. They act like this Santa is going to come down the chimney and steal their gifts instead of giving them. Like, it's such a big difference.
So I was just really heartened by that story.
Thank you.
I thought it was beautiful. And had I known that this was going on, I would have made sure my 4.5-year-old was out there, just because I just loved the whole concept behind that. And so anyway,
it's
really cool story. It's still up, easy to find at openmicrock.com. It's cool images. And,
thank you. He had a twinkle in his eye for sure.
Yeah, he did.
He was great.
Some Santas you meet and you know, you look and they got it. And some Santas you go, I know why my son doesn't want to go anywhere near you. It's very strange. But this was one you go, wow, this is like magnetic.
It's really interesting because they're fine with the white Santas that come in all grumpy and angry. But this black Santa was the most Santa I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And, you know, they really accepted him. And I like that.
That's great. So let me get a few more listener comments and questions. And just when my computer starts to die. Okay, so Matt in Irondequoit on the phone. Go ahead, Matt.
Hi, I was just calling to say, at my job, we get a lot of new people coming in and out, and a lot of my coworkers, they make comments when we get, you know, new black guys in there or women. They're like, oh, they all gravitate towards you, and I just say, you know, real recognizes real.
Ooh,
you know, I don't treat them any different or different than a white guy that's coming in or Asian or whatever it is. You just talk to them like a normal person, and, you know, that's what they are. And, you know, at first they're a little standoffish, but then they realize, hey, this guy's not treating me different because I'm black or this or that. They're just treating me like a normal person. So I think if people actually just were themselves and, you know, just looked at other people like, hey, that's another person. They go to the bathroom the same as me. They eat the same as me. You get a lot better along with each other. And, you know, another thing, I just want to thank you guys for that little chicken and waffles deal. I love trying different places to eat, you know, the Bobo's and, you know, the place in Irondequoit, the Soul Food, the old KFC place, you know. You know, I enjoy trying different food and different culture. You know, you can get a lot from other people if you just be real with them, you know, and not try to fake it or pretend to be something you're not or they're something that they're not. We're all people. So when you just look at it that way, I think you can really gain a lot as a society and just as a person.
Thank you, Matt. Anything you guys want to share on that?
I would say, you know, to his point, when real recognizes real, microaggressions are a way for us to identify who we can and cannot trust.
Amen.
And,
and
even if you don't realize what you're doing, as Nyland said, you know, we know ultimately you will not have our best interests. So when somebody is genuine, in regardless of race, gender, age, whatever, we can tell. We know.
Yeah. And that little moment of standoff he's talking about is us observing whether or not we're going to have those microaggressions pointed at us and say, oh, you know what? Maybe, you know, every year I got a promotion, I feel like I maybe get to get thrown in the bus. Maybe I don't want
to
work with them.
Or do we have to code switch? Do we have to change what we're going to do and not be real?
Code switch is its whole separate discussion. Yeah. We should come back and talk about. In fact, I think that came up when Tiana was sort of reaching out on social media about microaggression, and that is a its own discussion.
Seriously.
But Tiana, I got about 45 seconds left here. What can we look forward to next from Open Mic Rock?
Oh man, we have so many things in the pipeline. I think just number one, opening up our audience. We focused a lot on Native American issues. We're looking at refugees. We are looking at a lot more Latinx community. That's where that La Marqueta story came in. We have a lot of things in the pipeline. I mean, we are very passionate people, so I think you can really look forward to real news from real people and that you actually want to hear in the next year.
And ideally, we're sitting here a year from now, you're gaining sort of readership and growing?
Yes, but you know what? It's really not about readership for us or how popular we are. It's more so, are we starting the conversations that we need to have?
It's openmicrock.com, ROC, easy to find. Tiana Magnon is the editor-in-chief. Great having you. Thank you for being here. Michelle Ashley, nice seeing you.
Thank you.
The staff reporters, Vanessa Cheeks and Nylan Lovelace. Great talking to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
And we'll talk to you again on future media panels here. Let's get a short break and come back with more Connections next.